thanks to all the callers for calling in. I look forward to meeting even more people as the tour unfolds. I encourage people to dig into the evidence that I present, most recently in a couple of essays posted at GuyMcPherson.com.
Okay.
And the long essay there. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Yeah, he's got a long essay. Yeah, you're quite welcome, Guy. Thank you for taking the time to come on again. He's got a three-part essay that continues to revise, so that's worth reading in its entirety. Thank you all so much for listening. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, A Letter from Momo, will play Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. A Letter to Momo has been described as a Japanese anime Alice in Wonderland. As is so often the case in Japanese animation, displacement and emotional upheaval lead to interaction with the supernatural. Again, that's A Letter from Momo, Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 9th Annual Beloved Festival, an open-air sacred art and music festival in Tidewater, Oregon, held on August 12th through the 15th. It features a diverse lineup of music, workshops, and presentations across the festival grounds. Beloved will highlight the most cutting-edge electronic music and explore ancient traditions, illustrating the similarities between all of humanity. Again, that's the 9th Annual Beloved Music and Arts Festival, August 12th through the 15th in Tidewater, Oregon. More information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. The time is 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning. First, on Political Perspectives, host Per Fagering speaks with former professor, Portland professor Zahir Wahab and his wife Tahmina. They live and work in Afghanistan. Dr. Wahab is professor of education at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. At 10 o'clock on Flashpoints, a look at the ongoing protests against the Olympic Games in Brazil, a tech expert on the possible use of Pokemon Go by the CIA and the NSA, a look at the history of third parties in the United States, and a look at what many in the Green Party see as a smear campaign against their presidential candidate, Jill Stein. At 11 on the Dirtbag, guest host Gene Bradley interviews Bob Hatton, program director of the Portland Fruit Tree Project, and Weston Miller, OSU Extension Service horticulturalist. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. As always, if you're not a current member, you can resolve that issue by going to kboo.fm on the web and clicking on Donate. Thanks in advance for taking care of that. And we go now to Fight the Empire with Per Fagering.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering. I think the show is Political Perspectives, but we're always fighting the empire anyway. And my really special guest, who people here in Portland know, is Professor Zahir Wahab and his wife, Tahmina. Welcome, both of you, to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Per. Thank you. It's nice being with you.
So, well, you know, we keep hearing now that the war in Afghanistan is 15 years old.
Almost, exactly.
But that's sort of the overt war. You know, the real war has been going on quite a bit longer than that, at least since 1979, if you want to go back to the great game.
Yes.
But how are things now after all this effort, after all this killing and money spent and everything else? Where are we?
Well, where are we? We're, I think, back to where we were. I think the most recent incident was the kidnapping of two professors, an American and an Australian, who teach for us at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. And this happened in broad daylight on a main road in Kabul, where their car was intercepted by four armed and uniformed men and took them away. And we're quite concerned, needless to say. But that's sort of indicative of the larger security situation. And as you point out, yes, we have been there almost for 15 years now, and there's no let up in the war and the resistance. Security-wise, there really is no security in Afghanistan, including the capital. Abduction, kidnappings, organized crime is out of control, and it's mostly for ransom, sometimes for ideological reasons. There's war in about 30 of the 34 provinces. This is what the Ministry of Interior and the Pentagon and people would tell us. There's a new dimension to the war, as our listeners know. So far, it has been the insurgents in the Taliban versus the American, NATO, and government forces. And now the new dimension is Daesh, which many people on the ground really think that it's a new version of the Talib. Economically, the economy is in a coma because a lot of the internationals, civilian and military people have left, and that has led to considerable unemployment and underemployment and poverty. Development, there's very little development. The new government, which is almost the so-called national unity government, which was stitched together by John Kerry almost 2 years ago, against the Constitution, against the rules of law, against everything you can imagine. Because the presidential election 2 years ago was a fraud, and they didn't announce any winners, so the agreement was that you'll have a national government of national unity with two contenders, Dr. Abdullah and Dr. Ashraf Ghani. And when these two people were installed 2 years ago, they made certain agreements that they would work on electoral reforms, electoral processes and electoral mechanisms, that they will issue an electronic ID card, that they will convene a Loya Jirga or a National Grand Assembly to revise the Constitution to create this new position. None of those have been done. The government, the so-called government of national unity, because it's very much disunited. These two people and their followers dislike each other intensely. And the idea is that in any organization, government organizations, you appoint one person and I appoint the other person. So the minister could be from Dr. Ghani or Dr. Abdullah's camp, and then the deputy ministers could be, and these people from day one began to work against each other instead of working for the country. So things really don't look very good at all, whether you look at public opinion surveys or whether you look at people taking their money out in their families. Last year alone, some 200,000 Afghans left the country. That gives you an idea.
Oh, boy. What's it like being at the university now? That's in Kabul. Is it a secure place? I mean, do people live on campus, or where do you live?
Yeah, I live on campus. The American University of Afghanistan is actually in the it's in the western part of the city, sort of on the periphery of Kabul, in the nicest part of the city, and with open spaces and, you know, a big campus that is being built. This is a university that is barely 10 years old and has 1,500 students now, largely funded by the USAID and the U.S. Embassy, but, you know, other ways. there are a lot of expatriates, people from Canada, the United States, Nigeria, Pakistan, Iran, and other places who teach there or work. Life is very hard because, you know, as we said earlier, two of my colleagues were abducted this last Sunday, and we don't know what is happening to them.
So you
two Americans mm-hmm. were assassinated 2 years ago, mm-hmm. our colleagues. So you live with constant fear, although the university has these huge 10-foot walls with barbed wire, towers, sniper towers every...
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, and armed guards. The university spends about $2 million a year on security. Security cameras, metal doors, huge metal doors with... I have four locks on my door to the apartment. Mm-hmm. I live on campus. We really rarely venture out into the city because we're afraid. So in some cases, we're not allowed to go to certain parts of the city. We're not allowed to go out at night to, you know, to restaurants and things like that. So that's life. And Kabul is very, very filthy. The air is, the quality of the air is probably the worst in the world. Very congested, filthy, crime-ridden, you know, all of the negative attributes. So that's what we live with, and that's what we live and work.
Well, I hear are there a lot of high-rises there now?
Yes.
A new city superimposed on the old city? Or
yeah. You know, this is a city, when I was a child going to school, that was really meant for about 500,000 people and maybe mm-hmm. 100,000 vehicles. Today,
about the size of Portland, in a way.
Right. Mm-hmm. But now, because of the internal displacement and, you know, people coming in, immigrants returning, some of them, now you have about 5 million plus people in the small city. The streets are the same. You know, it has expanded. And the war, one of the consequences of the war has been sort of what Samir Amin would call maldevelopment. So you have these... incredible gaudy wedding halls and, you know, high rises, incredible palaces, people call narco mansions, on the one hand, and then you have massive homelessness, you know, and poverty. So it's really high rises built on sort of slums, like the favelas in Brazil or mm-hmm. In other places. That's the kind of, the city and the country itself are full of contradictions. You know, war is good business. It's very profitable, as you know.
Yeah, well,
both for American companies and for the Afghan mm-hmm. intermediaries, the rentier class, so to speak.
Right. Seems to be like a neoliberal global development, yes. The same all around the world. You
yes.
Know?
You know, mm-hmm. and the economic policy such as there is really dictated by the World Bank and the IMF and the World Trade Organization. So the country's open to, and an example of the absurdity here is that Afghanistan imports about $7 billion worth of stuff, from potatoes to automobiles per year, to fake medicine, to horrible staplers that don't work. But it exports maybe $4 million. So it's $7 billion imports, mm-hmm. $400 million exports. This is a neoliberalism in action.
Who makes up the difference?
The amazing thing is, well, you know, the West. Mm-hmm. The West, essentially. The thing is, for example, take electricity. We talked about this power plant that was finally finished after 50 years. The country has so many rivers, fast-moving rivers, that it could supply electricity to the whole region, not just the country itself. But it imports electricity from Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, while its waters flow out of the country to Iran and Pakistan.
What about solar power? Do you use much of that?
People have begun. There's some experimentation. Like on our campus, we have some solar lamps, you know, in the hub. But it's solar power, you know, requires an initial investment. Which takes capital. And a lot of people, the ordinary people who can appreciate that, don't have the capital. The government probably is not really interested because there will be no transaction. And remember, corruption thrives on transaction mm-hmm. When there is some kind of dealing going on. So again, solar and wind, of which Afghanistan has plenty, endless, supply and the water, but they're not being utilized.
We think it might make more sense, you know, because I've heard different things about dams. They're not always so great, you know. You know, they flood the, they take away a lot of farm. They have mixed results.
There's no planning. Mm-hmm. The problem is the sort of the quality of the work that is done. I look at that all the time. Whether you're looking at a sidewalk, for example, that is finished, or a building that was just, for example, the American University of Afghanistan, there's construction going on, repairs, new things. And you look at the quality of the things, the quality of the fixtures. Mm-hmm. Afghan merchants are known to import the cheapest things. So again, whether it's an automobile or oil or gas or staplers or building supplies, the absurdity is that Afghan cement used to be the best in the region. And now, the Afghan cement factory is dormant, but the country imports cement from its neighbors.
How did that happen? That's
because, it's the government. Even though there's the Ministry of Trade and Commerce, there's the Ministry of Economy, there's the Ministry of this and that, you know. Mm-hmm. But the output, the outcome of their work is not always visible. It's almost like a conspiracy by design to keep the country dependent and underdeveloped mm-hmm. on foreign brains, on foreign cement, on foreign tomatoes. It's amazing.
You got a perfectly good product.
Yeah.
But, you see this other places in the world, too, where countries that used to grow their own food, now they...
They have become poor net importers.
I think that's one reason why Venezuela's crashed, because they import so much of their own food, you know, they used to pay for it with their oil profits.
Except that I think in Venezuela, as you know, like in Brazil, Argentina, mm-hmm. and Ecuador, Uncle Sam is very busy trying to undermine
those
governments.
He's busy everywhere.
We're all over. Yes. And as I said, Afghanistan really is a case study in sort of deliberate underdevelopment and maldevelopment.
So what does Afghanistan export?
Some dry fruits. Right mm-hmm. now, it's the fruit season, you know, fresh fruit. And it probably has the best melons in the world.
Yeah, I've heard it used to be a wonderful agricultural producer.
The grapes, the melons, mm-hmm. the, you know, pomegranate, you know, other mm-hmm. kind of fruits and vegetables that I don't always see here, for example. Mm-hmm. But all these years, so the U.S. has been there for 15 years, and they have spent $65 billion on, quote, development, and about $1 trillion, of course, on the military operation. But mm-hmm. there are still no coolers. There are no cooling places where the farmers or the producers can store their products. So the markets are flooded with melons, watermelons, grapes, this and that, you know, and they're just, you see them everywhere you drive, on the roadside, because it all comes at once. Mm-hmm. There are no storage facilities, and there are no mechanisms and facilities to help them export these things. Mm-hmm. So they and of course it depresses the prices mm-hmm. and when you have an oversupply and an under demand. So that's the situation now. But still, the country. But as I said, all of its exports amount to $400 million, which is not much. It should be exporting billions and billions of dollars of, say, fresh fruits, dry fruits, carpets, lamb skins, for example, minerals, which we can talk about. It has some of the best and the rarest minerals in the world, but there's no mineral in industry, although there's a Ministry of Mining. The mining is done by illegal, insurgents and other groups, and export the product mm-hmm. cheaply.
Well, this is Per Fagring, and we're talking with Zahir Wahab and his wife, Tamina, about...
So if you'd like to ask her, I will translate for you.
What's going on in Afghanistan these days, after all this war and bloodshed and everything else?
And costs and lives and money.
Yes. Well, Tamina, tell me, what does... you are a teacher, too, is that right?
Shimon Megum Sodasin.
Yes.
Yes, she is a professor, university instructor.
Lecture at the university, Kabul Education University.
Yes, she teaches at Kabul Education University.
Let's see, put the microphone right close to you.
خونه
من رو اون دالتا هست. بخیر، من برای ترجمه میکنم. She has a master's degree and she teaches at psychology at Kabul uh-huh. Education University. And this is her first visit to this country.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes.
What are your impressions?
Oh,
I don't know.
Bugün.
De ce vă voie?
Chiar că mi-ai gufti bari mă migi.
English.
No, for ce bugün?
Nu megam.
She doesn't want to speak. Okay. Yeah.
Well, as somebody who teaches psychology, you one would think that all this years and years of war and horrors, what does that do to people's minds?
باعث یک روانشناس میگه امی سالهای جنگ با مردم چی سر مردم چی تاثیر کرده؟
خب نقصان زیاد رساند واضح از که حالت رویشان جسمیشان تمامشان تاثیرات منفی بجا مانده مثلا در رفتارشان در کردارشان در شخصیتشان دمشان تاثیر منفی گذاشته
She says the 15 years of war, protracted war, has affected people mentally, psychologically, even physically. And you can see this in daily life, in people's conduct, in their behavior, in their worries and concerns.
بخصوص از دادن دوستا نزدیکا یا قطع شدن اعضای بدن اینا همش تاثیرات منفی خود زیاد میگذاره.
She says people, a lot of people witness dismemberment or, you know, bodies that are torn apart. And all of these naturally would cause PTSD amongst people. People are traumatized.
Oh, trauma, jengi.
War trauma. And she said this is obvious in daily life.
And this can just sort of self-perpetuate. I mean, get passed down from one generation to the next, I guess.
شاید این دوام بکنه. یعنی تروما از یک نسل به دیگر نسل انتقال داده میشه؟
بله، چرا که افسردگی، استراب، ترس اینا چیزایی است که به گفته بعضی از دانشمندان مثل واتسن اینا که میگوتن محیطی است ما از محیط دوره یاد میگیریم مادری که از سگ بترسه طفلش هم همچنان از سگ میترسه این واقعیت داره که از یک نسل می آلات می ناراحتی ها با نسل دیگه اگر جنگ هم نباشه شاید دوام بکنه انتقال پیدا کنه
She says a lot of the like trauma, the worries, depression, anxiety, fear they perpetuate themselves from adults to children in families and in daily and work life. And so you get generations of people who are probably either depressed or anxious or fearful. And this is people sort of learn these things from others around them.
Is there any kind of help for people with emotional problems?
آیا در افغانستان برای مردم که مثلا مشکلات روانی داره کمک هست؟
بسیار کم یک تقریبا در کابل یک سه شفاخانه است یک دو شفاخانه دولتی است و تقریبا یک سه شفاخانه شخصی به خاطر تداوی امراض روانی ولیکن دو شفاخانه دولتیش معلوم میشه که دیگه به وقت کم مریضا را تداوی درمان میکنه یعنی مریضی مثل شیزوفرنی باشه که تقریبا دو سال سه سال تا تداوی درمان قرار بگیره او قدر امکانات وجود نداره در شفاخانه دولتی که مردم تا تداوی قرار بگیره صرف در شفاخانه شخصی خب فیسش یا معقول زمیش بسیار زیاد است فیسش
There is very little help available actually there are just two mental health institutions in Kabul government and three private and the quality of the care, the quality of the treatment is very, very poor. For example, cases of schizophrenia, which would take normally 3 or 4 years, they just keep them for a few months and then dismiss them. And I know this from studies by Harvard Med School and Johns Hopkins. People, you know, it's estimated that 85% of the people have some kind of a psychological problem and there's very little help available. There's no counseling, for example, at the universities, while young people who are going through transition and difficulties have all kinds of problems. We're just working on this at the American University.
What are your students like?
Where? At AUF?
Yes.
خو شاگردای تان میگه چی رقم است در پوانتونی کابل امریکایی؟ امریکایی
ما خوب جا قبلت نیستم خب بازم خوب هستن ولیکن متفاوت معلوم میشن گفت واضح است که نسبت به شاگردای پنتون تعلیم تربیه و پنتون کابل یا پل تکنیک پنتون امریکایی ها محصرینش متفاوت هستن نظر لازم از لازم مودشان، فیشنشان یا درسشان هر چیز که باشه.
There is a the Minister of Higher Education. And she says the American University of Afghanistan, the facilities, the instruction, these are probably the best in the country. Not probably, but they are. We know we were just ranked number one in the accreditation and evaluation scheme. But every year, all of the high school graduates take a university entrance exam. And because, for example, 300,000 people graduated from high school last December, and only 150,000 were allowed to enter tertiary institutions, two-year colleges, four-year colleges, special institutes, and so forth. The rest of them were turned away. And some of those people would come to the American University, but the American University of Afghanistan is also very expensive. It costs $5,000 a year, which is a lot of money in Afghanistan for a country where per capita income is $500. So I would say that at AUF, you get different kinds of students. One, you get very smart men and women, young men and women who are brought from all over the country who are on scholarship, full scholarship or, you know, 80%, 50%, so forth. The others are kids from wealthy families, naturally. We have kids who come with bodyguards, you know, with special cars.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yes, yes. You know. And then we have people who are sort of not very motivated and not necessarily very smart, who were rejected by the government institutions because they scored so low at the entrance exam. So somehow they will find the money to come to AUF. And we're just beginning to actually institute our own entrance exam. We just designed a special entrance exam for AUF because we know the demand is fairly high for the AUF because it's considered to be the best university in the country, and we want to be selective. But she says the facilities, and it's true, the AUF is the place where, you know, you have internet, fast internet 24 hours a day, classrooms, you know, all of the technology, and professors who are mostly PhDs. In the government system, only 4% of the instructors have PhDs. 35% have master's degrees, and the rest only have bachelor's degrees.
So where do the so after the students graduate, where do they go after that?
If you have computer skills and foreign language skills, you could find employment. Other than that, there's a massive problem of underemployment of young educated people. So I think there's a sort of an intellectual proletariat in the making, and soon it's going to backfire.
I think. Can see. They say the revolutionaries are the intellectuals who couldn't find a job or something.
Yes, and you see hundreds of thousands, and this is going to increase. It's amazing, you know, there has been an explosion of private education because the government is not equipped or willing perhaps to provide education K through college. So now you have about 120 private institutions of higher learning. This just happened in the last 10 years when there wasn't one, you know, when I first went to Afghanistan in 2002. But the quality, both in government and private institutions, like the quality of all things, from healthcare to food to farming to, you know, is very, very low and very poor.
Are these kind of, are they the religious schools, or what are they? Who starts these schools?
Yeah, well, there are two kinds of religious schools. One is government, of course, government-funded, government-sponsored, government-certified, and government-supervised. And you have these, you know, all over the country. But then you have the madrasas, like in Pakistan, the ones we hear about. And there are probably tens of thousands of those, or at least thousands of those madrasas, where they're associated with mosques, and they're not really supervised by the government. And those are the ones where a lot of anti-government, anti-systemic, anti-Western preaching still goes on.
Are they funded by the Saudi Arabians?
They're funded by, yes, Saudis are known to. You know, the Saudis are known, both the government and the private. I mean, the Saudis now, as you know, the recent revelation in this country, the missing pages of the warned, I think, the 9/11 report.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it indicates that the Saudi government does fund because it wants to externalize and export its problems to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a jihadi, go do jihad in Afghanistan or in Pakistan or in Yemen or other places.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it here. But there's also a lot of private money coming from the sheikhdoms, the Gulf states. We know, for example, that both Pakistan and to some extent I think Iran also support organizations and institutions that would sort of destabilize the Afghan system.
Well, it was KBOO Radio, and we're having a discussion with Professor Zahir Wahab and his wife Tamina, and we're talking about a situation in Afghanistan. And if listeners want to call in with a question, the number is 503-231-8187. Is there any kind of environmental movement in Afghanistan?
Yes. In fact, there is a green movement, and it's headed by the former chief of the National Security Agency, NDS, Mr. Amrullah Saleh. But again, it's civic organizations are just beginning, because this is a country where there was no tradition, actually, of even political parties. Political
mm-hmm.
parties, political movements, political organizations of one kind or another are recent phenomena. And the same is true with an environmental movement. People are aware. But the problem are systemic and structural. So Kabul, for one thing, the mayor, there's an acting mayor in the capital, if you can imagine. He has been serving for the last 2 years because the government and the constitution says that all of the mayors should be elected, but no such a election has taken place yet. And it's again government incapacity, government sort of entropy, government indifference. Kabul does not have a very effective garbage collection. Drive on any street, main streets, side streets, peripheral streets, and you see massive garbage, mountains and mountains of garbage. They can smell and breed diseases, and you see poor people, kids, men and women going through this along with mm-hmm. dogs and stray
animals.
Well,
this seems to be a worldwide phenomenon, really, when you think
yes.
about it. So one of the fruits of neoliberalism, I think.
Well, uncontrolled development.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with Kabul itself is there's no city planning. The city has no plan, and there has never been planned. And 70% of the structures are unplanned. This comes from the mayor's office.
Mm-hmm.
So it's chaotic. Streets, still most streets have no names. Homes have no numbers. There's no, again, not a systematic garbage collection. People burn anything to stay warm or to cook or to, for example, the public baths. Automobiles are not quite controlled, so you have very old vehicles using the worst gasoline possible, the cheapest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there are so many ways, to pollute the environment. And if I may, actually one minister of public health said that pollution in Kabul kills more people than the insurgents.
Wow. Well, we got I think we have a caller on the line. Nick is on the line. Good morning. Hello?
Good morning. This is Mr. Barnett, and I wanted to speak to my old friend, Professor Wahab.
Yes.
We worked together at Portland Lewis and Clark years ago.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Yes, I was wonderful to hear your voice when I heard that you were going to be on. I couldn't believe it. It was made me so happy. So I'm hoping you're fine. I hope you're okay and the wife is okay.
Yes, Nick, now, yes. And Nick, you worked for KBOO or you were the director for, remember?
Yes, for a couple of years. For about 3 years, yes. Uh-huh. So, how long will you be in Portland?
Just for two or three more days, and then, I want to go to a better, nice, peaceful place like Kabul. Safe, secure, and peaceful place like Kabul. good to hear.
I'm glad to have a chance to say hello. I imagine these couple of days you'll be very busy.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are lots of things to take care of, actually, and there's very little time for so-called rest and recreation. But Nick was yes. at Lewis and Clark Cottage. He was the head director of the, what we called the Junior Year for Action.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It was a federally funded program. Nick, right? We will get Lewis and Clark students to do things, you know, in the community, like work with KBU, work on Burnside, work here and there. And Nick directed that program, and I was involved with that program, too. And then we managed to see each other once every 10 years.
Do they have anything like that in Afghanistan?
No.
Maybe they should. Maybe there's a job for Nick in Afghanistan.
Yes, maybe. Nick, would you be willing to go to Kabul?
I might. Who knows? Tell me, do they speak Farsi?
Yes, Farsi and Pashto and many other languages.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have to brush up a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell Pierre to give you my phone number in case you can call me again.
Okay.
I don't think I have it.
Tell Pierre.
Yes. Huh?
I don't think I have your phone number.
971.
You can give it to the engine.
Okay.
The engineer, our engineer.
Yeah.
So stay on the line.
Thank you so much.
Stay on the line, and our engineer will take your number and give it to Zahir.
Good to hear from you, Nick. Thank you. Okay.
Wow. Well, gee whiz.
Yes.
It's like a reunion here.
Yes.
Well, let's go in and, you know, you. Afghanistan was sort of the scene of the great game. You know, let's talk a little bit about that. You know, that was actually, that was over 100 years ago that the Brits and the Russians and everyone were playing the great game. But it's, in fact,
do you want to answer the call or should we do this?
Let's take
our
call.
Yeah, we'll take the call, but come back because this is the issue.
Okay, we'll get back to the great game later. Thomas, you're on the air. Hello, Thomas? Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you now. Okay.
Oh, very good. Okay. Good morning, all. And I have
good morning.
A quick question for the professor, quick comment question. You know, I just sitting here, it's so refreshing to hear about what's going on and what has gone on in Afghanistan by people who live who spend time and live in the country, as opposed to listening to pundits or even well-intentioned correspondents or reporters that just spend a little bit of time there. It's so refreshing and so enlightening. And the two things I keep thinking about this morning when I'm listening to this is, you know, number one, what has to be the sort of question is what has to be the demonstration effect to people who live in all countries of the region, if not much of the rest of the world, the demonstration effect of seeing the United States and its Western allies sort of being, you know, the opposite of King Midas, in that everything they touch turns into the opposite of gold, and you have these showcase examples, these tragedies, it's beyond tragedy, it's an outrage, these examples of what's happened in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, and we could go on, but particularly those three countries.
Yeah.
Whoop. Did we lose our caller? I think we did, but he raised a point. Wonder.
Yes.
Of
course, it's very different to be there on the ground. For example, to have your colleague either murdered or kidnapped, for example, and to be living and working in a place where you don't feel safe any time, day and night, whether you're in your car or in your bedroom or in your classroom or going from point A to point B. You're always watching and you always have a bodyguard and you always have four or five heavy locks on your heavy steel door. So that's the kind of life, you know, and you're not allowed to go out, for example. There are restrictions all the time. And things happen all around you. For example, the recent explosion that took place at a demonstration that killed more than 100 people and injured hundreds. That was just about a mile and a half down the road from the university. And also for me to speak the languages and be born and raised there, you know, and I, of course, live in Portland now, I consider this as my country and my town too. It's very, very painful, frankly, and to see that after 15 years, we have done very little good. Whether you're talking about safety and security, law and order, clean government, good governance, good education, quality health care, drinking water for everybody, work and job and livable wages, a place to live in, a government that can take care of, flooded localities, a government that would bring you the goods and services that a government should. I don't see any of that. I see a parasitic, incompetent, corrupt kleptocracy protected by our tax dollars all the time. But also to see the culture, the vulgarity of the culture, so to speak, mm-hmm. from fashions to academic discourse, such as it is, to television programs. So they also have an Afghan television programs like Good Morning America or, something chatty. They have a basket of fruit on the table in the middle and people, it's exactly the same, men and women sitting around. You would think you're sitting in Portland watching an American, ABC.
Do they have a version of Fox News or anything?
Yes, we do. They do. Mm-hmm. So, and we haven't developed, Poverty has increased, underdevelopment, schools are closed. People go through the motions of whether it's government or work. Nothing gets done. It's a complete paralysis. The government is, the country's wide open, it's porous, it's borders, the government can't guarantee. Planes come and go day and night, actually, without the government either learning sometimes or, trying to control its airspace. So that's what we have done. We have created enormous inequities. There are Afghans who had nothing at one point and now live in very nice homes in Portland. Mm. I have to say, if anyone is listening. So this is what we have done, and I think we have just, again, almost destroyed a government as a country, I would say, an illegal, unconstitutional, imposed government on a people who are suffering. So that's all I can say, Uh-huh. And many people, actually, even people who are paid by the Americans, like some of our drivers or guards or the staff would say, we wish the Americans would just leave and leave mm-hmm. us alone.
Okay, well, we got another caller on. Thomas is back. Okay, Thomas, you're back.
Yes, I'll be brief. The phone somehow just dropped. Anyhow, what I was asking leading up to of my previous comment was, we see now that there's sort of this neoliberal maldevelopment experiments that are just leave uh-huh. in their wake the complete destruction of the fabric of society and all
yes.
Commonly measured social indicators of well-beings of individuals decline. And so in conjunction with that demonstration effect that can't be missed by anyone in the region,
uh-huh.
What is your sense that of a possibility? Is there any talk or any possibility that the Western countries, the United States, have so despoiled and have so betrayed the destinies of people, and not just in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. but Iraq, Libya, and elsewhere,
yes.
that there's a door open for a more of a natural trading partners or fair, or some sort of fair trade? Perhaps along the line of we know about the BRICS bank that's opening up and,
yeah.
and it's sort of this alternative block to the conventional sort of Euro yes. Wall Street model of development.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sense or is your sense that there's so much corruption and there's so many people that are strong that have been benefited, this mm-hmm. minority,
mm-hmm.
That they will act as a hedge against any sort of alternative real development for the people? And that's my, yeah. those
yes.
are my questions.
Well, I would say your last point. I really can say, that, again, Afghanistan is a classic case study of a neoliberalism imposed at gunpoint. And it's a clear case of using a territory for geopolitical and strategic purposes, and Per was trying to raise the new great game issue, which we really should talk about. All this talk about, counterinsurgency and fighting the Daesh and the Taliban and this and that, and terrorism, this is all rhetoric. It's all a farce. This is just to pacify and frighten the American public. If the United States and its allies were interested in really eliminating the insurgency or the Taliban, which they themselves created, remember? The Mujahideen and then the Taliban, and now people believe the Daesh are a clear creation of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan and their allies. Because there's a larger issue here. The issue is not so much to either develop or stabilize or democratize Afghanistan. If the United States wanted to do that, it would do that at home. My wife is shocked by the homelessness. We're just driving. We just drove here, and there were people who were sleeping on the Burnside still, brought in the open, on the sidewalk, on Burnside Bridge, you know, broad daylight. So if the U.S. indeed, the ruling elite in the United States, were serious about these kind of things, it would bring those things here at home, and then other people can say, wow, we want to build a country like this too, and they will do so. On the contrary, you know, what we have done is, again, wreck a country, its institutions, its culture, its values, and I don't mean to sentimentalize, you know, reactionary fascistic values or ideas or institutions, but decent values. You know, we have turned a country which was a net exporter of food is now a net importer of food, for example. We have spent $70 billion and the country still can't make pencils. It can't make aspirin. You know, it can't deal with its garbage system. We have a country where the capital is not safe. So this is what we have done. And again, you have a vast government apparatus which does nothing other than, you know, to promote itself, their families, their own interests, and so forth. Most high government officials, including the president, Ashraf Ghani, and the vice, the so-called CEO, Dr. Abdullah, their families live abroad. They don't live in Afghanistan. Most of the government ministers have two passports. We know that. They have made us known. So there's no commitment on the part of the government, and it's simply not competent. For example, the other day, one day we were sitting, there are 7 or 8 PhDs, Afghan PhDs, who have come back from diaspora at AUAF working. No one ever asks us for anything, like, do I have anything to say about education? I have a colleague who has 2 PhDs in math and in physics. What do you think about the physics program or the math program? We have lawyers, we have chemists, we have, you know, but because we don't kiss up to people and because we refuse to be part of partisan ethnic politics or political movements or parties, we're sidelined. We're not existing. And as I said, the inequities, the suffering, the underdevelopment, you know, and the maldevelopment, which is a direct consequence of, say, the neoliberal model, you can see that in Afghanistan. What might happen, we don't know. The one thing that there is a very thriving free press. Actually, it's freer than the United States.
Really?
Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. But 14 journalists were killed last year. Mm-hmm. You get beat up, you get threatened, you get your mother maybe injured, or you get killed. But there's a very thriving, you know, you'll be amazed to see some of the press. There's a lot of anger. All I can say is there's a lot of anger and a lot of frustration at the government, such as it is, and its patron, the United States. And when this anger would erupt, we don't know.
Do you see, sir? There again, the question of trade. It seems only natural that there seems like there's even more awareness of the mineral wealth in particular in Afghanistan.
Well,
it seems only natural that at some point there would be an opening where for trade. I mean, this can't escape India or China or Russia. The potential for trade with Afghanistan. It seems to me, is it going to take another? Do you think, in your estimation? It's so hard to look at these things and try to figure out the future, but is it going to take a radical shift in politics or is it going to take a more economic despair? What is it going to take for an opening to form economically for more fair trade and actual real development?
I don't believe in fair trade. I don't think there is, actually, whether you're looking at NAFTA or CAFTA or, you know, other places.
Less unfair trade.
Because, if trade is unfair between two unequals. Its trade is like between two unequals. So Afghanistan can't make pencils. Right? It has to import pencils, and, you know, you have to give whatever you have for cheap. Mining, as you probably remember, David Petraeus saying, you know, there is $1 trillion worth of stuff, which is true. Mining goes on right now as we speak, but it's all illegal. It's all by criminal syndicates in cahoot with the government, some of the government officials and the police. And you have heard about the resource curse, right? So unless and until there is a decent, honest, committed government in Afghanistan, you can take America's wealth and land it in Afghanistan, and it will still be the same.
Well, this kind of leads to a question I have. What about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
This is part of
China has these, yes. They're embarking on this kind of one road, one belt policy,
yes.
You know, with Russia and the various Turkic nations. And how does that, does Afghanistan fit in with that in any way?
Part of Afghanistan's problem is it's sort of a victim of its geography, because I really don't think that, again, the West or the U.S. are serious about, you know, again, terrorism or building Afghanistan, but it has every interest to counter, say, the Shanghai influence, Shanghai Cooperation Organization mm-hmm. influence. It has every interest to sort of move up through Central Asia and destabilize Russia.
That's a great the game.
West,
all
this
over
is the
again.
Great game. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, China is there in Afghanistan, and the Russians are coming in back. You know, they're training some of the military, they're sending weapons and things like that. And the United States does not like that.
Well, the Russians allowed the U.S. to use their roads to bring military supplies
that,
in and out.
Yeah, initially that mm-hmm. was done. But now, mm-hmm. as you can see, as Gorbachev said a couple of weeks ago, I think that the United States is trying very hard to move from a Cold War to a hot war mm-hmm. with Russia. So there's no question that, you know, the rivalry, the competition, ideological, but mainly economic, between the United States on the one hand and China and India and Russia on the other hand. And the new great game really is, as I said, Afghanistan's significance is in its geographic location, one, and it's also its resources, two. But also, if you can't exploit those resources, you do want to make sure that you deny access to your competitors. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what the United States is doing, to keep sort of China, India, and Russia at bay, but also to, of course, have a permanent base. Many Afghans now are really convinced that the United States does not want this conflict to end. It does not want the government to fall, but it does not want the insurgents to be eliminated either.
Well, it makes a lot of money for the weapons manufacturers.
Well, it makes money for the weapon manufacturer. It keeps NATO united, because mm-hmm. otherwise it will fall apart. Like, mm-hmm. But also it convinces the American public and distracts them. But the idea is that if the Afghan conflict ended, then there would be no reason for the United States and others to stay in that part of the world. They would have to leave. And this would be against the idea of the new great game.
Mm-hmm.
The new great game is on, and I think it is going to intensify, and we'll see what the end will be like.
Well, you know, it may run up against fuel constraints, because for one reason or another, oil is becoming either too expensive to
yes.
use or too cheap to make a profit.
That's interesting.
It goes up and down, and or becomes useless because it poisons the atmosphere.
Right.
So one way or another, oil gets taken out of the situation. Without oil, where is the Pentagon?
Right. Well, it's interesting. And, of course, when you speak about oil, Saudi Arabia is key. Mm-hmm. And Iran would be too. So it is. Isn't that interesting that oil prices fluctuate?
Mm-hmm.
The theory, the analysis in Afghanistan is, for example, that the United States deliberately puts pressure on its allies, the OPEC allies and others, to lower the prices to impoverish Russia.
That one theory. Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, so that's the reason why oil prices are down.
And also wrecked all this fracking in North Dakota, too.
Yes, yes. So, you know, all of this is sort of like politicized when the larger agenda, the larger issue, of course, is, you know, imperialism in its new form and its hegemony, you know, in that part of the world.
Well, the empire requires oil to move anything.
Yes.
And
yes.
without the oil, the empire is kind of stuck right here in the continental United
That's
States.
Right. And that know? Will have to be done because the local market, you know, is saturated.
Someone said,
I think Parenti said, like, capitalism and bicycle riding have something in common. They have to be in motion. Otherwise, they will fall.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stand still on a bicycle, it will fall. And the capitalism, to be contained and confined and to be inactive, would collapse. So you constantly are looking for new sources, new resources, new markets, new labor markets, etc.
Well, I think of a jet airplane. They're so heavy that they need a huge thrust to keep them up in the air.
Yes.
And without the fuel, they just drop like a rock.
Yes. So it shouldn't surprise people why, you know, the Afghan tragedy, I would say, the Afghan crime sort of continues and why it can't be solved. Because if the United States can read license plates from hundreds of miles up in the air, certainly they can see insurgents. They can locate them and eliminate them in 1 week. And now we have news insurgents, you know, the more brutal.
Well, I think part of that is that insurgency is a very cheap way of warfare.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
you see these American soldiers, you know, it costs $1 million to train them. They've got all this body armor and they're slogging through the heat, you know, or wearing 100 pounds of gear. And they're fighting some peasant wearing sandals and got a Kalashnikov or something like that.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, this is certainly asymmetric warfare, you know.
Exactly.
It's so asymmetric, it's always crazy.
And wouldn't that be, I mean, doesn't that surprise you that given all the paraphernalia the U.S. soldiers have, for example, versus the insurgent that you described, this is a, you know, this should be over very, very
one
quickly.
Would think.
but it's not. Somehow, you know, and there are many eyewitnesses have told me, you know, the United States actually moving things around. Supplying weapons to the Daesh or the Taliban.
Well,
and I don't think they exaggerate. I don't think they're lying.
That. I'd like to check that out some more. But
how the war in Afghanistan has been moved from the south to the north.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's all happening in the northern part of the country because that's closer to, and soon it's going to be in the Central Asian republics and then Russia. So the agenda, I think, consistently stays the same, whether it's Trump or Hillary Clinton. You know, as Chomsky said, it doesn't really matter because the American foreign policy, an extension of the domestic policies, is pretty much the same, no matter who occupies the White House.
Well, that's pretty true. I don't know. This is the weirdest election I have ever seen.
It's frightening.
And it's just, you know, here we are exporting democracy around the world, and our own democracy at home seems to be really falling apart.
Under attack. Yes, know? Very much.
I mean, not so much under attack, just kind of collapsing of its own weight and its own kind of inconsistencies. You know,
Afghans wonder, they say, how can they not this happen in the United States? Because they hear some of the rhetoric, you know, of the candidate. And they say, but in America, how can this happen in America? And I say, anything can happen in America. And in fact, he could win.
Well, you know, they say about America being very exceptional. In some ways it is. I think America didn't invent hype, but it really perfected hype.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And you can trace it right back to the beginning.
Yes.
I think we're getting near the end of our hours. This has really been very instructive. You're going to be going back to Afghanistan in just a few days?
Soon, yes. There's work to do.
I guess so. Gee.
She has work to do and I have work to do. Mm-hmm. But it has been interesting and very nice. It's good to come back to Portland. I would say, you know, enjoy and keep the relative peace. Although if you're black, I think you will have reason here to be worried.
Well,
but you know, enjoy and preserve the peace, the beauty, the tranquility, and the decency that is here.
Expand what we really have. You know, it's Is everybody, are the people in Afghanistan as outspoken as you?
There are people who are even more outspoken than I am. Yes, it's amazing. As I said, people take enormous risks because there is so much anger and so much frustration at the corruption, at the mismanagement, the ineffectiveness, the brutality, the sheer brutality. There's a lot of suffering in Afghanistan. Most people, this is a place where people do live on a dollar a day, if they can get a dollar, because there's no work. No work, no major projects have been undertaken, like dams, farms, factories, etc. You wonder what, you know, what happened to all this money in the 15 years.
Boy, it seems like this is something could blow any minute. Nobody knows.
It could
happen.
I keep saying, you know, the Afghan spring or the Afghan winter.
You know,
it's really not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when. Because, again, if you have half of the population under or unemployed, and you have 70% of the population who are under 25. You know, they're very young. This is a very mm-hmm. young nation.
Oh, boy.
And they see television now. People have internet. Mm-hmm. They have television. Mm-hmm. They see how the possibilities in life. And then they look at their own lives, which is, you know, like a grave almost. Mm-hmm. Wow. And so it's going to erupt one of these days. And I think if Washington cares, it should preempt a real troubling situation.
Okay, we've been talking with, spending an hour with Zahir Wahab and Tamina, and I really want to thank you both for being here with us. This has been very instructive, and
thank you.
I hope you can come back and see us again soon.
How long are we going to be doing this? I mean, when does this end?
Well, I don't know. We'll be here. I don't know. It's what you keeps know? Us sane, you yeah. know?
Yes.
So I'd really like to thank you very much for being
welcome.
With us.
Thank you for having us.
And I'd like to thank all the KBOO listeners and supporters, because you are the people that make all this possible. This is your radio station, and we are trying to keep it that way. So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
This is KBOO Portland. It's a 9:59. Stay tuned for Flashpoints. Today we're going to take a look at the ongoing protests at the Olympics, also the possible use of Pokemon Go by the CIA and NSA, also a look at the history of third parties in the United States, and what the Green Party sees as a smear campaign against their presidential candidate, Jill Stein. At 11 o'clock on the Dirtbag, guest host Gene Bradley interviews Bob Hatton, program director of the Fruit Tree Project here in Portland, and Weston Miller, OSU Extension Service horticulturalist. Stay tuned for all of that coming up after one little announcement.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 North.